Okay, so today, it's not the parsha this week because there's no regular parsha of the week until next week. Next week is Parsha Shemini. Since we're still in the middle of Pesach, so the theme, the topic is going to be Pesach, and specifically the last days of Pesach. So one of the unique aspects of the last days of Pesach, halachically, is that we do not make a blessing Shehechiyonu. So Shehechiyonu is the blessing which we make whenever a happy, joyous occasion arrives during the year. And, whether it be a yontif or even actually buying a very special article of clothing, if you buy a new suit or a new dress, which you don't normally get so often. So that warrants a Shehechiyonu. We also make a Shehechiyonu when we shake the lulav and esrog, any new mitzvah which arrives during the year. So every yontif we make a Shehechiyonu, which means Hashem has kept us alive, brought us to this occasion. We're very thankful, very appreciative of being able to do this mitzvah. So we made a Shehechiyonu on the first night of Pesach. We also made it on the second night of Pesach because of in the diaspora outside of Israel. So we have Yom Tov at the beginning. We have the lower levels of Kedusha sanctity during Chol HaMoed, and then it goes up again to the last days of Pesach. So it has a full force of a Yom Tov, and it's called Yom Tov, but we do not make a Shehechiyonu. We don't make the blessing of arriving at this new special occasion. And the reason for that is because, contrast this to the last days of Sukkot. Last days of Sukkot, which is otherwise known as Shmini Atzeres or Simchas Torah. So on that Yom Tov, we do make a Shehechiyonu, even though that's coming at the end of Sukkot. And the distinction is because Shmini Atzeres is a whole different Yom Tov. Simchas Torah, Shmini Atzeres, with respect to Sukkot, is a brand new Yom Tov, even though it's the end of Sukkot, and colloquially we call it the last days of Sukkot, but it's really not correct because Shmini Atzeres is not the last days of Sukkot. It's after Sukkot is already over. It happens to be, right up against Sukkot and the day after Sukkot. So we call it last days of Sukkot, but it's a brand new Yom Tov, and therefore on that Yom Tov, Shehechiyonu is recited at Kiddush. But Pesach, the last days of Pesach, it's really genuinely called the last days of Pesach, but it's not because it's part of Pesach, and that's why we don't make a Shehechiyonu, because it's still part of Pesach. So Pesach began, and it's ending now with these last days, and it's not a brand new Yom Tov. It's the continuation and actually the culmination, the climax of Pesach, and therefore Shehechiyonu is not required. But the question is, so why is it a Yom Tov? What does it correspond to? Every Yom Tov corresponds to a historical event. So Pesach itself, the Exodus from Egypt, is the historical event, and that's what generated the Yom Tov of Pesach. What's the historical event of the last days of Pesach? The last days of Pesach correspond historically to when the Jewish people arrived at the Reed Sea. I've been trying to correct myself all week long right now because for years I've been saying the Red Sea, and it's not really the Red Sea. Yam Suf. Yam Suf is the Sea of Reeds. So I had a class yesterday, was discussing with some people yesterday about this, and the one person said, "Well, isn't it, I think it really is genuinely called the Red Sea." So he sent me, let me just read this. He sent me an email this morning to clarify this. I don't know where he got this from. Let me just read this email. He said, looking up the name origin, the similarity between the names Red Sea and Sea of Reeds appears to be a coincidence. The sea is named Yam Suf, Sea of Reeds, in the Bible. Although reeds do not grow in salt water, it is thought that there was a nearby freshwater collection of reeds that contributed to this Hebrew name. The name Red Sea is a direct translation from the Greek and probably originated from the red hue of seasonal blooms that occur in the sea. So I don't know. So maybe it's still justified to call it the Red Sea, but probably the best way to call it is Yam Suf, because that's the original words themselves in the Hebrew. So Yam Suf, the Reed Sea. And the point is that the Jewish people came to the Yam Suf on the last day of Pesach, corresponding to the last days of Pesach, and that's when the sea split, when they came to Yam Suf and the sea split. This is the seventh day after leaving Mitzrayim. And two questions I'd like to ask. Two questions. Number one, first question is, why did Hashem do this? And if we think back to the whole story of the Exodus, was the culmination of an unbelievable experience, a sensational experience for the Jewish people of their final deliverance, their final liberation. And it really began, I think we discussed this several weeks ago, it began with the Makkah of Orov, of the wild beasts, because we have this tradition that the plagues, that the actual slavery in Egypt came to a formal end with the plague of the wild beasts. So 6 months even, and that was the fourth or fifth plague. And so six months even before they left Mitzrayim, the slavery in Egypt came to an end. So the whole experience of the slavery was really winding down 6 months before they actually left Mitzrayim. So everything was getting better, and they were watching Egypt fall to pieces, being struck by the Makos, and eventually they leave Mitzrayim, and they're just walking out in the midst of this incredible fanfare of miracles and spectacle and the divine presence which revealed itself on the night of Pesach, which we reference at the Seder itself. It was unbelievable, and the miracle of the speed of leaving Mitzrayim and all the things which happened for the Jewish people, it was just unbelievable. If we were there, we would just be dancing with joy. And they were dancing with joy, marching out of Mitzrayim, just looking behind them and seeing the downfall and destruction of Mitzrayim. And they get to the Sea of Reeds, the Yam Suf, and in front of them is the Yam Suf, the Sea of Reeds, and behind them, a few days after they left Mitzrayim, after they left Egypt, the Egyptians begin chasing after them. They have a change of heart, even though initially they were happy for them to leave, but they have a change of heart and they come chasing after them. So you can imagine the Jewish people standing there. We're all excited. We're all so full of joy and enthusiasm and hope. And we're standing now by the Yam Suf, and we're trapped, literally trapped by the Yam Suf, with the sea in front of us, the Egyptians chasing after us, behind us. Why did Hashem do this? What was the point? Now, they don't know that the sea is going to split. They have no idea. But they thought it was all over. And the sense of like despair, and the sense of, is this a big joke? So that's a question. Why did Hashem do that? Another question, technical question. It's very interesting. When you look at the account, the narrative of the Exodus and the splitting of the sea, which hasn't yet happened, but before the sea split, so there's a series of verses, and as you know, always we see that there's always nuances. When you look at the Hebrew carefully, you see nuances which you wouldn't have seen otherwise. And in chapter 14, verse 22 of Exodus, 14:22, it describes the moment when the Jewish people arrived at the sea, before the sea split. And the verse says that Yavo b'nei Yisrael, the children of Israel, walked into the sea onto the dry land. And this is the moment when it split, because eventually they started walking into the water. And the verse reports that they walked into the sea, onto the dry land, and the wall became like a wall to the right and to their left. That's verse 22. You go down a few verses to verse 29, and it's almost a repeat, with a slight difference. It says, the children of Israel came onto the dry land within the sea, and the water was a wall on each side of them. Now, I said that quickly. I don't know if you notice the difference. The difference between the two verses is, in the first verse, it said that the children of Israel went into the sea onto the dry land. And in the second verse, it says the children of Israel went onto the dry land into the sea. It reverses it. And you'd say, okay, so not such a big deal. You know, poetic license. That's not true. That's one question. So why does the verse change the order, the sequence of what happened? Into the sea, onto the dry land, or onto the dry land, into the sea? That's question number one. Another question, which is much more, requires a little bit more of a microscope to look at this, but when it says that the water became like a wall to their right and to their left, a wall. So the word for wall is choma, The word for wall is a choma, which is spelled chet vav mem hey, choma. So in the first verse, it says that chet vav mem hey, choma, wall. In the second verse, it says choma, same pronunciation, but the violation, but there's one letter missing. It's spelled chet mem hey. Now, it can still be pronounced as choma, as wall, but it's missing a vav. I'm having this deja vu of about two or three months ago, and I became obsessed with the Vav. Remember that? The Vav. Remember the hook, the Vav. Anyway, it's not going to be the same thing over here. But in the first verse, it's spelled Chet Vav Memhe with a Vav. In the second verse, Wool is spelled without the Vav. And that's a question. So two questions, right? Two questions in the verse. Why does it reverse the order? And why is it missing the Vav in the second verse? That's the second question. The first question is, what was Hashem doing with this whole thing in the first place? Why was he putting them in this place of challenge to make the sea split? What's all this about? So I'm going to come back to this. I'm going to answer this afterwards. I want to take us on a complete digression. And I said before that it's nice to learn things from visual aids. So we're going to learn about a pair of shoes. We're going to learn about the significance of a pair of shoes. And the title of this class is called Goody Two Shoes. So you remember that, right? This class is called Goody Two. We have to be a Goody Two Shoes. My kids didn't know what that meant, so I thought maybe it was some kind of British expression, but then I clarified it with someone else. It's an old-fashioned expression. But we're going to become a Goody Two Shoes today, because we're going to learn about shoes. And I found this because I came to this really, I'll tell you why in a few minutes. It was really through the agency of my son at the Seder night, because of something he said to me. But the lesson of the shoes. So in the morning blessings, we recite a whole series of blessings. You know, Uri was telling me before about the blessing, the morning brachot, the morning blessings. We thank Hashem for our eyesight. We thank Hashem for our clothes. We thank Hashem for our ability to walk, all the different faculties that we have. And it's printed in the Siddur, and we say it in the shul. But the original format of reciting these morning blessings of appreciation, the Gemara says, was to do it in conjunction with the different activities of waking up. So as you wake up in the morning and you open your eyes, you make a blessing of, thank you, Hashem, for my eyesight. As you sit up in bed, and you can sit up and you're not, you know, God forbid, a person's not, God forbid, paralyzed, and you can get up, then you make a blessing, Mati Asurim, that Hashem, thank you, Hashem, for releasing the bound. And all these blessings all correspond to different parts of the process of getting up. As you put your feet on the ground, you start walking, you know, from the bed to the bathroom, we make a blessing that God directs the feet of men, of people. So that's what we don't do it today because for technical reasons, because we're supposed to go to the bathroom before making blessings. You shouldn't make a blessing when you have to use the bathroom. So the format of how we make these blessings today is we do it afterwards when we're in shul. But the original idea of how these blessings were to be recited was to correspond to these different activities of getting up in the morning. So one of them is the blessing Sha'asa li kol tsarkei, that God has provided me with all of my needs. That God has provided me with all of my needs. But that blessing is recited corresponding to when you put your shoes on. That's what the Talmud says. When you put your shoes on, make the blessing that God has provided me with all of my needs. Thank you, Hashem, for providing me with all of my needs. And the question is why? What does putting your shoes on have to do with that? So someone said, famous Hasidish, individual, Reb Zusha, this is the person who said, gave the answer to this. He said, for example, let's say I had a $1,000 mohair suit. Now I know what a $1,000 mohair suit is because my father made me a $1,000 mohair suit. My father was a custom tailor. I remember when he made me this beautiful mohair suit. I was the only yeshiva bacher wearing a mohair suit. And it was a nice suit. But if someone would offer you $1,000, maybe more than that, whatever, a mohair suit, and offers it to you for $100 because it doesn't fit you, it's not your size, would you buy it? Would you take it for $100? Yeah, it's a little bit too big, a little bit too small. Would you buy it? Yeah, for sure you'd buy it because you could just take it to the tailor to fix it, to make it, you know, your size. Let's say someone offered you $1,000 pair of shoes for $100. But they're a little bit too tight, or they're too tight on you, or too big. Would you buy it for $100? You buy those shoes for $100? Jan says no, because there's nothing you can do with a pair of shoes which doesn't fit. You can't fix them. You can't take it to be tailored to fit your feet. So shoes, of all of the all of the garments, all the articles of clothing that we have, shoes are the one article of clothing which is made perfectly to the feet. It's perfectly tailored made to the feet, to the size of the person. So shoes symbolize how everything in life is tailor-made for us. And, you know, we face challenges. We have situations. We have things in our life we're not always so happy about. And things happen to us. Sometimes we make choices which we're not so happy about. But an axiom of our belief is everything is tailor-made. There's Hashgacha Pratis. The divine providence is running the show. God's running the show. And everything is tailor-made. And that's why the blessing, Sh'asali Kol Tzarkei, that God has made for me, provided for me, all of my needs perfectly tailor-made exactly for me, corresponds to putting my shoes on, because the shoes, putting your shoes on is the symbol and the reminder that everything is custom designed for you. That's what the shoes represent. So that's lesson number one of the shoes, right? And good. Lesson two of the shoes, right? So lesson one of the shoes is faith in Hashem, that everything is by design. That's the first lesson. The second lesson of the shoes, and the reason I found this, because I'll tell you the background behind this, the Seder night, so my son Gershon was sharing with me something which he learned in yeshiva, and the bottom line message that he'd learned from his teacher was, in order to merit Hashgacha Pratis, divine intervention in one's life, we have to be an Eved Hashem. We have to be a true servant of Hashem to merit that Hashem's hand will be on our life. We have to merit that, to be an Eved Hashem. So that lesson, that idea was really resonating and ringing in my ears the next day in Shul. So I was thinking about that, and then we came to the Haftorah reading of Shul. And I'm going through the Haftorah, and I'm struck by something really interesting, because the end of the Haftorah, I'm not going to go into the subject matter of the Haftorah, but it's from the book of Joshua. And the specific verse is Joshua chapter 5, verse 15. And the verse basically reads that an angel speaks to Joshua and says to Joshua, the angel says to Joshua, the angel said, Shal na'alcha me'al raglecha. Take your shoes off your feet. Ki amokam hasha'ata omed alav, because the ground upon which you're standing is holy ground. And I'm looking at it and I'm thinking, you know, that sounds awfully familiar to me. Take your shoes off your feet, because the ground you're standing upon is holy ground. And I see people are nodding their heads, because there's a famous verse in Exodus when Moshe comes to the burning bush. Almost verbatim, the same words are used over there as well. That God said to Moshe, take your shoes off, because the place you're standing on is holy ground. I thought, that's really interesting. I look at the verse up, and it's literally, I mean, almost identical. You know, the verse in Joshua says, Shal na'alcha, and I'll talk about this in a second. Na'alcha is singular, actually. Take your shoe off. So that's, and but in the verse with Moshe, it says, take your shoes off. Shal na'alcha, take your shoes, plural, off. And the other difference is, in the verse in Joshua, it says, because the place upon which you're standing is holy. With Moshe, it says, the ground is holy. And aside from those differences, it's an identical instruction. So that caught my curiosity. So I looked into the different commentaries, and I found the Malbim. Malbim is a very famous Bible commentator. And the Malbim explains, and it's really amazing, a beautiful idea. So I'm just going to focus just on that the first difference, that in Joshua it says, take your sandal, take your shoe, singular, off. And the other one says, take your shoes, plural, off. So the Malbim explains, a very important idea. What are the shoes? What do the shoes symbolize? So we've learned about this before, I think, that the shoes, what the shoes are to the body is to the soul. Right? The shoes, we need the shoes in order to walk through life, to walk out into the streets. So the shoes protect the body. So what the shoe is to the body is to the soul. But the body is the receptacle, is the house for the soul. So shoes represent the body. So the shoes represent the guf, the body. But the Malbim says that there's actually two aspects to the body. One aspect of the body is the plain, brute, crude, physical desires of the body. And the other aspect of the body is the mind. That's also a part of the body. So when God was speaking to Joshua, now he goes into this distinction between different prophets. There are different prophets which we have throughout history. Moshe was the greatest of all prophets. He had the greatest, clearest vision of all prophets that ever existed. The other prophets were not as didn't have as clear of a vision as Moshe. So God is speaking to Joshua as a prophet, and he's speaking to Moshe as a prophet. The nature, the instruction being given to both of them is slightly different. With Joshua, he said to him, take off your shoe, your singular one shoe, because a regular prophet had to at least be in control and have not be overpowered by his physical desires, right? That was a prerequisite to becoming a prophet, have to have complete self-control over all one's physical desires and passions. That was a given for any prophet. Therefore, when he said to him, take your shoe off, in order to have a prophetic experience to reach this level, you have to be prepared to take your shoe off. Your physical, you have to be prepared to suspend and titrate your physical desires. That you have to do. To switch your mind off, to let go of your mind, which is the other part of the body, the mind. The mind is, you know, part of the body too. You don't need to do that. Regular prophets had a, and I don't, this is a bigger topic, not for now, but it's the difference between what prophecy was exactly and the difference between Moshe's prophecy and the other prophet's prophecy. But other prophets, the presence of their mind was more extended in their prophetic experience. They had their mind was more involved, and actually one of the words which is used over here is the power of imagination. Imagination and mind. For other prophets, there was much more of an activity of the mind and the imagination in the prophecy. But Moshe, he said, take both of your shoes off. Take both of your shoes off, because for Moshe to reach the level that he had to reach, and to become almost like an angel in heaven, he had to be prepared to let go of his second shoe as well, which is let go of his mind. He had to switch his mind off, whatever that meant in the prophetic context. But it was a complete subservience, a complete and utter letting go of every aspect of the physical body. Take off both shoes. So that's the difference between the singular shoe of Joshua and the plural shoes of Moshe. So that's nice with respect to prophecy. I'm not going to be, I mean, I'd like to make a prophet, but I don't think I'm going to become a prophet. That's prophecy. But what's the message for us? What's the dumbed down, diluted message for the average person? I think there's a very powerful message over here. Because Moshe, aside from being the greatest of all prophets, he's also described in the Torah as being the quintessential Eved Hashem, the quintessential servant of Hashem. It was because he was the quintessential servant of Hashem that he had this level of prophecy. But what allowed him, what brought him to that level of complete, a perfect prophecy of this clear vision that he had, and to be this quintessential Eved Hashem, he had to let go of everything. He had to be prepared to suspend all aspects of his physical experience. He had to take off both shoes. He had to take off the shoe of desire and also switch off the shoe of the mind. And I think that's a very, very important lesson, a very, very applicable idea to all of us, to me, I mean, to speak to myself, that, you know, that to become an Eved Hashem, to become a servant of Hashem, to become a true civil servant or a divine servant, we have to be prepared to let go. We have to be prepared to let go. There's a lot of desires which we have, a lot of passions which we have, and that's a given that we have to be able to have regulation of our desires. But one of the hardest things to let go of is our axioms, our beliefs, our mind, the things we think about, the beliefs we have, the beliefs and the ideas and the axioms which have been ingrained inside of us throughout the decades of our life. And oftentimes, much of the axioms and the beliefs that we have in our minds are not necessary. They didn't come to us by our own choice. They were fed to us by experience. They were fed to us by our upbringing. They were fed to us by our education, which we didn't necessarily choose per se. But you know, sometimes the education experience can be positive, can be negative as well. There's a lot of ideas which have become ingrained inside of our minds, and part of the process of being a true servant of the Almighty, a spiritual servant of God, is to be prepared to let go. And I always use the expression that Bart uses, to suspend our disbeliefs, to be able to be prepared to suspend our disbeliefs, to give space to a new idea, to new concepts, to new ideas. That's part of being an Eved Hashem. So two aspects, and it's taking off both shoes, taking off the shoe of desire and taking off the shoe of the mind. That's what brings a person to being an Eved Hashem. So I saw that. I thought it was so beautiful I was excited because when I chose to take the lesson of Gershon, my son, of trying to be a little more of an Eved Hashem, and I decide I'm going to pay attention to the Haftorah. So Hashem was, kind to me. He gave me this insight and he led me to this understanding over here. So that's two lessons of the shoes. The first lesson of the shoes are that the shoes represent that everything is custom designed for us. That's the blessing Hashem has provided all of my needs. And the second lesson of the shoes are that they represent our physical body in all aspects of the word, both in the physical desires and also in our minds as well. And part of the process of becoming a better servant of Hashem, devoted Jew, is letting go of those things and being prepared to entertain new approaches and to suspend those aspects of our body in that process. And that's the two aspects of the shoes. So that's the lesson of the shoes. When we're putting our shoes on, we're taking our shoes off, we can really, think about those ideas. But how does this tie back to Pesach? So if we go back to Pesach, because I have those questions, I left you with those questions. So we go back to Pesach and we think about what happened when they left Mitzrayim. So I don't want to confuse you too much, but there's a mitzvah which we do at this time of the year right now, which we started on the second day of Pesach, which is called the counting of the Omer. And this is the counting of the days between Pesach and Shavuos. After we left Mitzrayim, we start counting these days. And the idea is anticipation and excitement towards coming to Mount Sinai to receive the Torah. And to receive the Torah meant being given the instructions and being given the kind of the program of what it means to be an Eved Hashem, to be a servant of Hashem. So we start that mitzvah of counting the day right away after Pesach. The unusual thing about it is we don't begin counting on Pesach itself. We begin counting the day after Pesach, the second day of Pesach. And the question is, why don't we just do that? If the whole idea of leaving Egypt is to march towards Mount Sinai to receive the Torah, to receive the instructions of becoming an Eved Hashem, to be a servant of Hashem. So why not do that immediately, as soon as the first night of Pesach? So the Sefer HaChinuch, a very famous commentator, says the reason why we don't do it immediately is because the first day of Pesach needs to be undiluted. The first day of Pesach is a focus on really, really appreciating the divine providence of Hashem, of performing all these miracles, and to really realize that Hashem's in control. We don't want that message to be diluted. So that message is devoted to the first day of Pesach. The second day, that's when you can now focus exclusively on the second dimension of we're leaving Egypt to become servants to Hashem. So the second day is now focused on that aspect, and that's when we begin the counting towards Mount Sinai, when we're going to be given those instructions on how to be a proper servant to Hashem. So day one of Pesach is faith, the belief in Hashem, that everything Hashem's controlling everything is a miracle. And the second day is the beginning of that process of counting, of becoming a true servant, of being a servant. I thought, wow, that's really good. That corresponds to my shoe message. Because the message of the shoes is the first message, again, of the shoes were everything. God's in control. He's controlling everything. He's performing all the miracles. He's behind everything. That's day one of Pesach. And the second day of Pesach is the second message of the shoes, right? That we have to be prepared to let go and to take our shoes off in life sometimes. That's part of being subservient and being a true servant to Hashem. And they're the two messages of Pesach. So that's what happened when we left Mitzrayim. But that message and that process, that lesson which we're supposed to learn, was being built up. And the climax of that message arrived at the Kriyas Yamsuf, the splitting of the Red Sea. Because it's all very well receiving the divine providence of being taken out of Egypt and the blessings of that experience of being taken out. And then the truth is actually counting those days. I forgot to mention, the mitzvah of counting the days didn't begin until after Mount Sinai. So, we have the mitzvah today of counting the days. The Jews in Egypt, when they left, they didn't start counting then. So they didn't really quite have that second message inculcated, the second message of being servants to God. So when did they get that full message? When they get to the splitting of the sea. Because now they're marching forward and they get to the sea, and now they are completely and utterly trapped. They're trapped. And they're looking back behind them. The Egyptians are chasing them. They're looking forward. The sea is blocking them. Is this a big joke? Is God playing a game with us? No. This is the opportunity to put into practice the message of leaving Egypt. To put into practice faith that God is in control, that everything is being designed from above. And ultimately, to let go. To let go of everything. Just to let go. Have faith and trust and be prepared to let go. Put behind us our ideas, our fears, our desires. Put it behind, have trust, and just march forward, walk forward, just keep walking. If this is the job, if this is the responsibility, don't be afraid. Don't be trapped by our beliefs and our axioms and all of the things behind us. Let go. Take our shoes off. Take your shoes off. Now, I don't know if there's no source I have that when they walked into the sea, they took their shoes off, but it would fit nicely. But who walked into the sea first? Who walked into the sea first? It was Nachshon ben Aminadav from the tribe of Yehuda. And the Medrash says that he was the first one. The sea was blocking them, but he lived this idea. He let go. He put it all behind him. He took his shoes off and he walked into the sea. He just walked right into the sea. And the miraculous, and it says the Medrash said, he walked into the sea and it came up to his nostrils. And then that's when the miracle happened. And that's when Hashem made the sea split. And all of a sudden, the sea split. It became dry land. Verse 22, right, which said they walked into the sea onto the dry land, is referring to that group, to Nachshon ben Aminadav, and those who followed him had the same level of faith, who were prepared to let go. And for them, it said they walked into the sea onto the dry land, because that was the experience. The Vilna Gaon explains the verse 29, which reverses the order and says they walked onto the dry land into the sea, refers to those Jews who didn't have the same level of faith, because the Jewish people had different varying levels of faith coming out of Mitzrayim, even though they merited to come out of Mitzrayim, but not everyone was the same. And there were some who didn't have the same level of trust, and they were terrified, they were afraid, but they were able to be carried along by the faith of those who did have the faith. For the others who waited and tarried, so the second verse says they walked onto the dry land, which was within the sea, alluding to the fact that they waited for the dry land to appear before they were prepared to walk into the sea. So the first verse is referring to those who walked into the sea, which then immediately turned into dry land, and the others waited for the dry land to appear before taking their first step. The second group didn't necessarily take off their shoes so quickly. So now the other question was, why in the first verse does it say it says the word for wall was choma with a vav, but in the second verse it's choma without a vav? And the answer to that, says the Vilna Gaon, is that the word choma without a vav, you know, you can change the vowelation of that word, and without the vav, you could also read the word not as choma, but chema. Same letters, different pronunciation. What does chema mean? Fury, anger. Because the second verse is a reference to those Jews who didn't have the same level of faith. And therefore, for them, there was a little bit of a divine anger against them. They were merited to go through, but God wasn't so pleased with them. And that's alluded to in that absence of the vav, spelling now the word chema, fury and anger. So the second verse is that's what the second verse is referring to. But the first verse, right, the first verse is the verse which really reflects those Jews who had this pristine level of faith in Hashem and willingness to be subservient completely by letting go of everything and putting everything behind them and taking their shoes off to be able to walk into the sea. And in that came the miracle right away. And I just thought it was just, you know, the message is in our own lives is that we all face challenges. We all have challenges, whether it be, you know, God forbid, health challenges, relationship challenges, or even religious odyssey challenges. I think that's a very important one, the religious journey challenge. And there are times we have to, you know, it's difficult to make changes to kind of travel that journey of walking into the sea. And oftentimes it seems like a stormy sea. It seems very, very difficult to be able to make that step. But the lesson we learn from Kriyas Yam Suf, from the last days of Pesach, the lesson we learn is that it takes a little bit of letting go, of letting go of the desires, certainly, but also letting go of the beliefs, of the axioms and the thoughts and the fears and all these different things which are in the mind, the second shoe, letting go of that. And just march forward. And all of a sudden, a stormy sea could end up becoming a tranquil place of peaceful dry land. And not to be afraid, just walk right in, it'll be fine. So that's the message of last days of Pesach. Take our shoes off. Remember the shoes, everything's designed from Hashem, but be prepared to let go. Take the shoes off and just march forward. Go on, walk into the sea. Take your shoes off, take your flip-flops off, and walk into the sea.